Welcome to How I Wrote This, a show about writers, their books, and the story behind their stories. I'm your host, Pamela Hensley, and in season two, I traveled to Berlin. Learn what it's like growing up in a divided city, fleeing the country, living here as a Jewish expat. Join me as I speak to winners and contenders of the German Book Prize, the Thomas Mann Prize, the Dublin Literary Award, and the International Booker. Season two of How I Wrote This begins on April 23rd. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Ryan. We just completed our special presentation of Among Equals. I hope you enjoyed that departure from our regular programming. If you did, I encourage you to mosey on over to the Among Equals feed in your favorite podcast app, as we're in the midst of putting out bonus content. There, you can hear longer interviews with the experts that help us put the series together. Learn about Morisseau, Wojcik, Beardy, and the others. All the stuff that we wanted to include, but just couldn't contain the five-part program. Today, as we're in between seasons, we're lending our feed to one of our podcast friends. I was recently a guest on an episode of North of Normal, another podcast series that talks about Canadian film. The host, Andrew, and myself discuss Guy Maddin's 2003 feature film, The Saddest Music in the World. I also encourage you to go over to the North of Normal feed, check out other episodes in their catalog, including their ongoing series on the works of David Cronenberg. And don't forget to rate and review. Happy listening.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is North of Normal, a podcast about Canadian cinema and our relationship with film. My name is Andrew Hunter Scully, and today we are discussing The Saddest Music in the World, released in 2003, directed by Guy Maddin, written by Guy Maddin and George Toll, based on a screenplay by Kazuro Ishiguro. And to join me, we have Ryan Barnett. Hello, Ryan. How are you doing there?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. Talking from Montreal.
That's right. Yeah.
Understand correctly? Thank you for being here. This is a first time on the show for you. As we like to say around here, it's good to get new blood in once in a while, just get different conversations going. Kind of had a long streak of kind of relying on my regulars, a lot of ideas had come up. So we had to get through a lot of those before we could get around to doing ours.
Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Definitely, no problem. And you reached out to me for this, and that is awesome because you as well are a podcast host.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I host Once Upon a Time in Hollywood North.
And why don't you let the people know what your show is there?
Sure. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood North is a narrative podcast. We have taken one topic and covered that topic over several different episodes. And really what it is, it's a production history behind Canadian content. So our first season was a 6-episode plus 2 bonus episodes about the Kids in the Hall. So the career of the Kids in the Hall from their time as at the Rivoli up until doing their show on the CBC to doing the Brain Candy film. And our latest season was about the career of David Cronenberg. So it was the early years. So everything from Shivers up to where'd we stop? The Dead Ringers, I think, is where we stopped.
So I will be completely transparent and honest with you. Before you reached out, I had not listened to your show.
Yes.
But for a very specific reason.
You're not alone.
I didn't want to seem mean about it. So let me explain here. I know how much work goes into these shows. And whenever I come across a show that we cover similar subject matter, I don't like listening to it because I don't want to take the research.
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
It makes total sense.
Obviously, people who do interviews, you know, that are creative, that are involved in the film, I'll listen to those. I'll use those all the time. Like when Sarah Polley was on What the Fuck with Marc Maron, like I definitely use that for research. But when I know that it's somebody going out there and pulling up information themselves, doing the work, I don't want to listen because I don't want to lift. Because again, I respect how much work goes into this. People see how much research I end up doing on this show with the different sources. They're always relatively surprised, right? Especially if you don't just scour a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
So when you reached out, because I had seen your show pop up a couple of times here and there, and because we do cover very similar subject matter, obviously we have done episodes on this show about the Kids of the Hall. Mm-hmm. We have obviously the Cronenberg series that I do with Skyler that we've been doing for years. So when you reached out, I decided to give them a listen, and I blew through them. I think I blew through the first two seasons in about 5 days.
Oh, great.
I loved it, and it is an absolute relief on my part that we are very different shows.
Yes.
Like we are very different beasts.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, obviously mine is a lot more loose than yours. Yours sounds amazing. The production is incredible. So if anybody is listening to this and has listened to our episodes on The Kids in the Hall or our Cronenberg series, definitely give your show a shot. Definitely give it a listen. It is a totally different experience. And like I said, a lot more polished, I'll say it, professional sounding. But what blew me away is the recent series that you're doing. Do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to. So Among Equals is, we call it a special presentation of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood North, because it's kind of to the side of kind of what we do normally. And the focus of that series is it's about the legacy and the history of the Professional Native Indian Artists Incorporated. So this was a group of seven Indigenous artists who formed a collective in the 1970s, basically to raise, you know, not just their own profiles, but raise essentially the estimation of Indigenous art in Canada at that time. So they were, you know, it was in that group, there was Norval Morisot, who, you know, is probably the most famous name to come out of that. And then Daphne Ojig and Alex Janvier, those are known as like the big three. And then there's Jackson Beardy, Eddie Kobanis, Joseph Sanchez, and Carl Ray. So that was the group. The Winnipeg Free Press called them the Indian Group of Seven. That's kind of like the colloquial name that they're known by. But so we're doing a 5-part series on the history of that group and their importance in Canadian art and in world art. And it's not hosted by me. I kind of play the what you would say in Quebec, the fou de bois. So I'm the kind of the guy that asks the dumb questions during the series. And we have a wonderful host, Soleil Lonier, who takes us through these stories, and it's filled with interviews with Indigenous curators and fine artists, as well as family members of the group, as well as and Joseph Sanchez as well, who is one of two of the last surviving members. So he and Alex Janvier are the only ones who are still with us today. And Joseph was a consultant on the project and is a voice throughout the series.
Yeah, I just really wanted to bring it up because obviously you've seen my show list. I'm very familiar with the subject matter that you covered in your first two seasons.
Yeah.
And this one has totally blown me away. It is a subject matter that unfortunately is a rather large blindside to me. I'm not a dummy when it comes to Canadian art, but
yeah.
The amount of detail and the light that you're showing and giving the voices there, which most even like the average art fan like myself just don't have those stories and that information. So I just wanted to say great job. I'm absolutely loving it. And again, anybody who might be listening to this episode, definitely give that series a shot because I'm definitely glad, not least of all, I got to meet you, but it forced me to listen to your show, which I really enjoyed. And then this amazing series that you're currently doing there.
Oh, no. I really appreciate that because it's the result of about a year of work. And yeah, for us, it's a super important topic. And, you know, we've been putting out on the Once Upon a Time feed, but it also has its own feed. So if you want to find it, it's just called Among Equals. It's basically anywhere you can get a podcast. So yes. And if you're a teacher out there who's listening to this and you're interested in incorporating it into any sort of class lesson, we actually have learning tools and listening guides available on actually in the show notes. So you can download ways that will allow you to incorporate this into your class lessons.
That's really great to know. I have had a couple of teachers reach out that do listen to the show. So maybe that's something that might be of aid to them. Now, this is everything you've put out so far with the show, both series and this side one that you refer to. It's under the banner of Knockabout Media. That's a production company.
That's right. Yes, that's my production company.
That is your production company. Okay. I wanted to make sure in case people wanted to look into that. And the big question I have for you, because I have my own story why I wanted to start covering Canadian film in this show. Why tackle that subject matter, especially with the effort that you put in? Like, obviously, it would be something you're passionate about, but what made you land on it?
Yeah, well, I think it was a couple of things. There was this genre of podcast that I really liked listening to, which was this narrative podcast that was multi-part. So there was one thing of, okay, I think I want to do a podcast, but I think I want to do something that's a little bit more research-based and tells a story over several episodes. Before starting Knockabout, I worked for an organization as a producer doing long form and short form history projects. One of the things we produced was the Heritage Minutes. So I come out of this, work history of kind of taking these big topics and boiling them down for kind of public consumption. So I wanted to do something that I felt was within my skill set. And then the reason I landed on Canadian film is just, I feel like no one was really doing that with Canadian film. I mean, there were shows in which people were, talking about movies, but they would, shows like yours, where you talk about a movie, but it's within the confines of one episode, which, is its own thing and is great. But for me, I wanted to make it more of like a drama. And I try to end each episode on like on a cliffhanger, like what's going to happen next. So that was really where it started. And I initially had pitched it to the CBC as the series, because they had, in the early days of the pandemic, they had a digital fund or something where they were asking for pitches for digital projects, and it didn't get picked up. But I was just like, I've done this kind of initial pitch work, so I think I might be able to make something of this. But that first season was really slow going for me. It took a long time to write. And Cronenberg similarly took a long time to write. But that's really where it came from.
Well, it sounds great. It really did blow me away, because I really didn't quite know what to expect when I started listening to it. Yeah. I was just like, oh, wow, this sounds really, really good. The only other thing that I'll note about your show, because obviously we do have a topic we need to get to.
Yeah.
Who does the voices? Because I'll explain this really quickly about your show. Not only is it just you talking at the audience, but you have these sort of little vignettes.
Yeah.
Like these sort of little side scenes of, instead of just quoting what the actors are saying yourself, you have an actor doing... His Kevin McDonald is spot on, let me tell you, but reciting the lines, that's kind of the way that it's played with. And I was just really curious about who does that, because some of them are really, really good.
All of the male voices are my older brother, Matt. Unless I feel like it sounds like he's talking to himself and I might put my own voice in there, it's literally my brother. And the way I thanked him for doing all that work in season one, because his Kevin McDonald is amazing, is I got him a cameo from Kevin McDonald.
Oh, wow.
it was my thanks to him. And he said it was like the best thing anyone's ever given to him. So
that's amazing. Well, pass on that. I think his David Cronenberg is better than my impression.
Well, there's David Kirk. What did I say to him when I started? I said, would you mind doing season two as well? And by the way, you're going to have to do Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, God. Yeah, of course.
But no, he's been a really good sport. I can fire him over a script and he'll have the recordings for me in a day or two. And it's been amazing, because he's really good with voices for some reason.
Well, pass on our compliments from here.
I will.
And apparently the next series that you're working on, you have the side one right now, but the next one is going to be on John Candy.
That's right. Yeah.
Which I'm looking forward to, because obviously I grew up with John Candy.
Yeah.
Watching him from a very early age on SCTV. That's where I first saw him. But aside from individual projects here and there, because he didn't do a lot of Canadian film work, my research has not taken me too much into the realm of John Candy. So I'm hoping that there will be a lot more surprises for me. Like, I'm really hoping that it'll be as eye-opening to me as this side series that you're doing.
Yeah, I hope so. It's funny when you talk about that whole not consuming other podcasts that kind of tread on the same material. I had that with the Kids in the Hall, because I was putting out the podcast the same time that documentary came out. And I was like, I can't watch the documentary.
Yeah.
I can't watch the documentary, even if it's just because I got something wrong. And I was really happy when I watched the documentary, because I felt like they actually complemented each other really well.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping for you as a listener, like, I hope, you know, what you learn about John Candy is exciting. But yeah, it will be the next one. I'm excited about the prospects of it, because I was just at showing of Home Alone at the Place des Halles here in Montreal, where they had a live orchestra doing the John Williams score. And when John Candy came on the screen, the crowd cheered. It was just the spontaneous cheering. I was like, oh, like, people, yeah, there's this like this collective warmth towards him in this country. And I feel like we miss him, and we're reminded, you know, around Thanksgiving and around Christmas, how much we miss John Candy, because we have Planes, Trains, and then obviously Home Alone that are on TV all the time during those pockets of the year. So I'm hoping people will come back to the show and take in the John Candy episodes. I'm not sure how many episodes it will be. It will be at least 5. I've always planned to do 5, and I always go over 5. So we'll see, but there'll be at least 5 episodes in the new year on John Candy.
When that airs, you should come back on the show so I can remind my listeners to go and check out that it's actually available.
I'd love to.
Okay, so on to the topic at hand, Guy Maddin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had typically when somebody reaches out, especially if I don't know them, like, it's one thing when I hang out with somebody on a regular basis and we over beer, we can be like spitballing ideas for like future projects and stuff like that. These sort of situations where somebody reaches out or I reach out to them and it's more of like a cold contact situation, there's a back and forth. Usually the person who got in contact with me has a list of films, and I kind of fire back with my ideas and we go back and forth, and we whittled it down to the saddest music in the world, which I was super happy to do. We haven't done any Guy Maddin on the show for ages. I think the last one that we did, well, we did My Winnipeg quite a while ago, and then we did a short episode, like a episode of shorts,
right,
like short Canadian films, and we did The Heart of the World, because right, that is one of my, that's my favorite thing Guy Maddin has ever made. So I just wanted an excuse to talk about that. So we paired it up with a couple of other short films, things that we felt couldn't take up an entire episode necessarily. So we finally settled on that. Now, before we get to the saddest music in the world, though,
mm-hmm,
what is your relationship with Guy Maddin?
What is my relationship? I think my relationship actually, it's funny. There's a few ways in which I've intersected with Guy Maddin in my life. So I think the first one was the saddest music in the world. And I have this vague memory of seeing it reviewed on Ebert and Roper, which is something, you know, growing up, Siskel and Ebert were huge to me. I think listening to Once Upon a Time, I think you'll see how important Siskel and Ebert are to me, because they're in like every episode. So that was my first kind of introduction to him. And I just remember the review and remembering seeing the scenes and the beer legs and all that. And thinking, this is fascinating, because at the time I was in university, and I'm a big fan of silent film. I'm a big silent film guy. So seeing that someone was making something in that aesthetic was really interesting to me. So that set me on kind of a Guy Maddin dig. And then in 2013, we were doing a podcast project, and I had the opportunity to interview him while he was doing his seances project here in Montreal.
Okay, yeah.
So I've had the opportunity to interview him, and he's great, super charming guy, loves to talk about movies, and is just a great interview. And then more recently, my wife, who's a filmmaker, she had gotten a grant, and with that grant, that grant was essentially going to set her up with a mentor, but the mentor was hers to choose, and her choice was Guy Maddin, and Guy Maddin essentially mentored her for a year in the making of a film of hers. So we've intersected a few times in these really, you know, tangential ways. Can I say that? But I come to him as a fan. I come to him as a fan and an equal admirer of the work he admires and tries to emulate and basically absorbs and puts back out into his films. And this is one of my favorite films of his.
Yeah, this was really great for me, because it's a Maddin that I hadn't revisited for a very long time.
Yeah.
I as well am a pretty big Guy Maddin fan. I can't quite remember which my first one was. It might have been Saddest, actually, and I might have done what you did, which is jump back after that. But then obviously after that, whenever I could see anything in the theater like My Winnipeg or anything like that, I would. Now, we're not going to do a deep dive into the background of Guy Madden. I tend to save that if it's possible in the future, we'll do their first film. I just kind of like that balance. But right, if anybody listening, any of our non-Canadian or people that aren't familiar with Guy Madden, just really quickly, born in 1956 in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Guy Madden and Winnipeg are basically one and the same at this point. Went to school, I believe, for economics originally, but then started hanging out with the sort of local film scene, film clubs, and then finally transitioned into film. Now, you as a Guy Madden fan, why don't you describe his style that you refer to that you really liked?
Oh, sure. So he's an expressionistic filmmaker. Some people kind of describe his films as fever dreams. And they're really rooted in this kind of silent film aesthetic. So if you watch a film like Murnau's films or Carl Dreyer's films, he's really kind of pulling from these inspirations. So things are typically in black and white. They're typically shot on either 8mm or on 16mm film. So they're grainy and they have that kind of older film stock quality. They can be quite beaten up. And then also they have this that quality that nitrate film used to have too, where it almost like glows. There's almost like a halo around the characters. Mm. This bright kind of halo around them. And then his editing style, nothing's really edited to continuity. It's more edited for pace and feeling. And then I think he also claims Douglas Sirk is a influence of his. So, you know, it's a lot of melodrama. So there's a lot of comedy, a lot of really like satire and comedy, but a lot of melodrama involved in his work as well.
I really liked, speaking of our buddy Roger Ebert, I as well visited his review of this film off of his website. I just like this as a summation of Guy Madden's films. Old film from an alternate timeline. Satirical nostalgia for a past that never existed.
That sounds about right, yeah.
So leave it to Roger Ebert. And randomly, this was not planned, I had a very interesting experience. A couple of weeks ago here, the Carbon Arc Cinema nearby was doing a screening of Archangel, his second film. Now, when it popped up, tickets go really quickly, and I don't like going to the movie theater by myself. So I just grabbed two tickets, right? I was like, I'll find somebody to go with me. And my friend Colin, who's been on the show quite a few times, just reached out being like, hey, dude, what are you doing this weekend? I'm like, well, I got this extra ticket to this Guy Madden film. Do you want to go? And he's like, sure. And of course, we go to sit down because we meet up at the theater. And I'm like, so have you seen any Guy Madden before? And he's like, I have no idea who he is.
Oh, right.
And I'm like, this is going to be great. This is going to be really, really interesting. The post-conversation that we're going to have. Because when he comes on the show, we tend to do like the 70s Tax Shelter era schlockier stuff. Right. That's more his wheelhouse of what he likes, right? So that was really interesting. Just seeing Guy Madden. We've lived with Guy Madden for so long. You kind of take for granted how, not impenetrable, but how obscure he can be as an experience if you aren't used to him. Like, what was the other thing Roger Ebert used to say? That this Guy Madden film is unlike anything you've ever seen unless you've seen a Guy Madden film before.
Yes, yeah, I remember that from the root. Yeah.
I think is what he would say.
Yeah.
But anyways, I wanted to share that because that was a really interesting experience there. And, you know, we were talking afterwards and I was kind of explaining how Archangel is, you know, his second film and it's a little bit more impenetrable than some of his later stuff, depending on what film you're talking about. But we decided for our next movie night, I'm going to make him watch My Winnipeg because that's by far and away his most accessible film in terms of just a lay person watching, but he's seen Guy's weirder side, so he'll understand the sort of odder elements of My Winnipeg. Anyways, I wanted to touch upon that. That was a really cool experience to see that film projected because I'd never seen that one before.
It must be touring now because it's playing tomorrow night at the Cinema Public here. So I just noticed that in some research today. So so that's cool that it seems to be touring and people can see it.
Now, out of all of his films, is it just because it's your favorite? That's why you decided on Sadness? We usually like to get an idea of like why this particular film.
I think I would have done My Winnipeg if I were to pick a favorite film of his. But this film being kind of the first introduction, it also feels like his first big swing. So I think it's an interesting film to talk about. I think his relationship with Isabella Rossellini is interesting. I think she's an interesting figure to talk about. And like I said, it was the first one I saw. And it was the one that put that name in my head that's been there since 2003. Is that when this film came out?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So I thought it was the perfect one. And it was in terms of looking at what you've covered on the show, you hadn't covered it. So I was like, you know, of the three or four titles I gave you, I was just as happy to do this one as any of the other ones.
Not to put you on the spot, but it is typical of the guest to explain for the audience what is saddest music in the world. That's why I leave it up to the Skylar and I hand back and forth for the Cronenbergs.
Okay, so it's the story of a family. There's one is a brother who's a failed Broadway impresario who's come back to Winnipeg kind of with his tail between his legs, but he's eager to get back there, back to New York. And there's a beer baroness. Is that what you call her? A beer... what do they call her? Anyway,
I believe they refer to her as a beer baroness. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Beer baroness, played by Isabella Rossellini, who has decided to put on this contest to find the saddest music in the world. So people, representatives from countries all around, come to basically play their music, and the winner will get a certain amount of money. And this kind of cad, played by Mark McKinney, who is this failed Broadway impresario, decides he's going to enter in on behalf of America and he's going to win this contest. But of course, the other person that becomes his main rival in this contest is his brother, who has returned and is going to be representing, I think, Serbia. And also the hook too is that Mark McKinney's character is now paired up with the former wife of his brother. Did I cover enough of it?
As good of a swing as you can possibly do. Thank you very much, man.
And hilarity ensues.
You know, in typical Guy Madden themes of betrayal and affairs, and it's not technically, I guess, incest in this film, but that's the thing Guy Madden likes to go to once in a while.
Yeah.
But if anybody thinks that sounds heavy, it's a Guy Madden film, so of course it's really, really funny. It was so interesting during the Archangel screening hearing the audience react to the film, and it's, I call it cascading laughter. You'd have this thing where one person would kind of chuckle and find something funny, yeah, and you'd gradually hear across the theater people either thinking, oh, that is okay to laugh, or oh, sometimes it almost seems like a kid that feels like they're missing out, so there's that fake laughing. And once I pointed out to my friend Colin, he couldn't miss it. He's like, it was so funny.
That one is an incest story, isn't it?
That one is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so as typical with this show, we're just going to go into a really brief background of this particular project itself. Mm. To note, this is Guy Madden's 7th feature film. He was quite prolific in the 90s leading up to this film, especially for independent Canadian film, just not cranking them out, but that's a lot for a Canadian filmmaker. So as we said in the intro, it is based on a screenplay by Kazuo Ishiguro, the acclaimed novelist. He wrote the screenplay in the early 80s before becoming a novelist. Two of his novels have been adapted into films that he both wrote the screenplay for. The Remains of the Day, starring Anthony Hopkins, which is a movie that I absolutely love and I should really go back to. It's been too long since I've seen it. And Never Let Me Go. And later he wrote the screenplay for Living, based on the movie Ikiru by Akira Kurosawa. That was a movie that I was a little bit suspect of, because why remake Ikiru? It's one of the mm-hmm. greatest films ever made, but I was pleasantly surprised by it, just to throw my 2 cents in there. The fact that Ishiguro wrote the screenplay and the fact that it starred Bill Nighy kind of swung me to the side of giving it a shot. So the original script was set in London and the then present day of the 80s when the script was written. Madden says he was down on it at first for those reasons, though the premise of the saddest music contest was strong. So he got together with his longtime early collaborator, George Toll, to work on the screenplay. Just to really quickly note on their relationship and their collaborations, the plot is mainly Madden who comes up with it. They bounce ideas back and forth. And in this time period, it was George Toll who would kind of do the dialogue, essentially. So that in those early films, that Madden-esque dialogue that people refer to is a lot of the time George Toll. Like, he's putting the words up on screen there.
And he was a professor of Madden's at one time, wasn't it? Remembering the correct guy?
I believe so, yeah. He ended up collaborating with, you know, obviously other students and teachers across the board, but I think you are correct there, yeah. So they completely rewrote the screenplay, essentially keeping the title, the premise, and the contest at the center. They moved the setting to Winnipeg in a time period Madden was more comfortable with, the 1930s, otherwise known as the Great Depression, that Madden thought worked better for the premise and also the themes of the plot. And also the term Great Depression can be a double meaning in this instance. Inspired at the time specifically by corporate and government schemes to commercialize the suffering in Eastern Europe. Bad had noted it was the first time he made a film that wasn't based on his own obsessions. It shot over 24 days in the abandoned Dominion Bridge factory for an estimated $3.8 million. Now condemned, to note, it is also where he shot The Heart of the World that we brought up before. Now, one thing I have to get out of the way about Madden, especially doing research for this, he is, and I didn't know that you knew him, so it'll be interesting your take on this.
I don't, again, I've glancing encounters.
Of course, yeah. But still, it's something that I didn't know. Yeah. When I'm doing research on Madden, the one thing that you have to be aware of, especially when he's doing interviews, he has this aspect that he really likes fibbing. Sort of exaggerating situations and kind of mythologizing things. So there's some facts that I had to...
I've written in my notes, fabulous.
That's probably a better way to put it.
Yeah.
There are some stories that I won't repeat here about the background of this film that I have omitted because I really question whether or not Guy Madden is telling the truth about that aspect, right? So if you go out there and read interviews from around this time, there are some really funny anecdotes about the making of this film that I didn't feel comfortable repeating. Because either it's wrong or I'm stealing his material, right?
Right.
So this is one of the facts that, you know, you got to keep this in mind. He was told that the factory was insulated and heated where they were filming. This turned out not to be the case. During the filming was what Madden referred to as the biggest cold snap in Winnipeg history, claiming the temperatures would sometimes get as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius, which we can talk about when we talk about the actual film itself. Things that you can notice. He noted that it caused discomfort on the set, but had perks, like they could use real snow and even have a frozen pond on set.
Right.
One thing Mark McKinney said that I really liked is that he said that one of the benefits of the cold weather is that there were no third takes because your lips would be frozen. So it really kind of kept things moving at a quick pace and kept people from being too precious about things, shall we say. It's a short one for this one. Not that much out there.
Well, if you're cutting all the bullshit, sure.
Well, we'll touch on some of the other background things we'll touch upon in terms of the cast and stuff like
sure,
that.
Sure.
Well, this came up also a lot in My Winnipeg, right? I always say after I saw My Winnipeg in the theater, it was before I even had a smartphone. The first thing I did is that I went straight home. I didn't go out anywhere. I went straight home and went onto Wikipedia and Google to fact check everything that he claims about Winnipeg in that movie, right?
Yeah.
All right, shall we move on to the cast?
Sure, yeah.
We have Mark McKinney. Obviously, we are both pretty big Kids in the Hall fans. I was quite excited that he was in this, playing Chester Kent, the failed Broadway producer, as you mentioned. Obviously, he was in the Kids in the Hall, both the troupe and the television show that ran from 88 to 95. To note on this show, we have talked about Mark McKinney when we did the documentary you brought up, Comedy Punks. We did do an episode on Brain Candy. And though it's not Mark McKinney, we did do an episode on The Wrong Guy. That was something a friend of mine really wanted to talk about. Just to talk about his career leading up to this point, after Kids in the Hall, he was in Saturday Night Live between 1995 and 1997. If you look down his filmography, he's in a lot of bit parts in comedies, a lot of the shitty Saturday Night Live films that were coming out at the time. So movies like A Night in the Roxbury and Superstar, and he also has a bit part in the movie Spice World, the Spice Girls movie.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, take a look at his filmography. You could really see how much of an outlier this role is, right? And kind of a really different thing for him to kind of show his talents. And we wanted to note, because we love the show here on North of Normal, and we have covered it, so he was on Slings and Arrows from 2003 to 2006. And most recently, most people, especially outside of Canada, probably know him for Superstore from 2015 to 2011. He's always a fascinating interview. Always a fascinating interview. I'm really glad that we've done Slings and Arrows, because there's now a Slings and Arrows podcast where they're going through and interviewing the cast members, and there's an episode with him. Just always a delight. Out of all the kids, I think he would be the most personable, like the one I'd want to meet and just kind of sit down and have a conversation with.
That's interesting. Okay, yeah.
Anything you want to say about Mark McKinney?
Talking about where he was coming from, for me, yeah, I love the Kids in the Hall. For me, I agreed with Lorne Michaels that they were the future of comedy. And then after that, that show ended, it was really hard watching him on SNL
Yeah.
It was, I remember
watching the audience just not react to the chicken lady.
Yes. Yes. Seeing the one time he tried the chicken lady and just dying on the vine. Love Slings and Arrows. Am happy to see him do anything of quality. Superstore is a show. I took a little writing break from the house. My wife got me a Airbnb for a little while, and I was just away from the house to write. And between my writing sessions to kind of recharge, I caught up with Superstore, and I just love to see him in anything that's good. And again, for me, catching up with this on Saddest Music in the World on Ebert, it was Mark McKinney that made me go, oh, Mark McKinney's in something. And that's what drew my attention to this film in the first place.
Interesting. And we will move on to Isabel Rossellini, otherwise known in this film as Lady Helen Port Hunting. Now, Isabella Rossellini, huge career. We can only scratch the surface and not do her career any justice at all. But obviously the child of Roberto Rossellini and Ingrid Bergman. She is a former model who had been acting for quite a while by this point, most notably in where I first saw her in Blue Velvet in 1986, a movie that I saw way too young. Neighbor at the Cottage should not be showing a 10-year-old Blue Velvet, even though it is really, really good. But it did introduce me to David Lynch at a really young age. So there you go. And the only other role that I want to kind of call out here, because I absolutely love the movie, is that she does the voice of the grandmother Shell in Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. That came out a couple of years ago, peak pandemic. That was one of my favorite movies of that year. It is absolutely delightful, and I've made so many people watch it. So obviously, she is still active. Now, her involvement in the film is a little bit interesting. The story of how Guy Madden approached her is one of the interesting stories to look up, because it is obviously fake and not a real story. But it was actually George Toles who wanted to specifically write a part for Isabella Rossellini in this film, because as Guy Madden said, we had never really worked with a movie star before. And I guess George Toles was a really big fan, and Isabella Rossellini is a very adventurous actor and always has been. Looking back at Blue Velvet as an example, the story that I came across that I thought was really funny, and I think you might like. So Guy Madden was really surprised that he got a message from Rossellini when she agreed to be in the film, that she was going to come up a month early and wanted to meet with Guy Madden. And Guy Madden claims that that is because she was probably a little bit suspect about the overall respectability of the film, like not in terms of like risque content, but the quality of the content. And who is this guy up in Canada that is trying to get me up here for this? One thing Madden said that I thought was really funny is that they just ended up sitting on his couch watching old movies for the entire month. And she saw Madden's love for old films and what he had been working on and was all on board at that point. I just think it's really funny. Isabella Rossellini sitting on Guy Madden's couch for a month in Winnipeg in winter is just one of the funniest visual things that I can think of, really, especially if you've seen where Guy Madden lives or lived in. He's still in Winnipeg, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I know he taught in the States for a while, but... Yeah.
I also believe I don't know if this is contemporaneous for when Isabella Rossellini would have been there, but I also believe he lived in a house that once belonged to his mother as well. So you imagine that couch might be covered in plastic or something. Or...
And it is important to note that they would continue to collaborate after this film through the years, including the short My Dad is 100 Years Old and Guy Madden's feature Keyhole. So they've had a long working relationship after this.
For me, my first introduction to her was Death Becomes Her, where she plays that kind of sorceress. But she's fantastic. I love her mother. I love her father's work. Mm-hmm. I love when somebody is in a place in their in themselves, but also in probably a financial place too, where they can make choices like this. I always talk about Daniel Radcliffe as someone who has more money than God, so he just makes really interesting choices, and I feel like she's this very classy European woman that kind of grew up in this social strata that she can go, you know what, I want to do an interesting movie in Winnipeg this winter. I want to do this. I want to do that. And she continues to do really interesting work, and I think she's fantastic, absolutely fantastic in this film.
Yeah, it's funny in regards to Daniel Radcliffe. And this pertains to this.
Did you think he'd be coming up?
I can't remember. I'm not a Harry Potter guy, so it's always surprising. but I can't remember who originally referred to it as this, but they were referring to Daniel Radcliffe, and they would refer that they had fuck off money. So whenever somebody like Isabella Rossellini comes up, the first thing that pops to mind is like, oh yeah, she had fuck off money.
Yeah.
Like that's the term that's now baked in my head. Yeah. Next year, we have Maria de Medeiros as Narcissa. Most people probably know her from Pulp Fiction. That is definitely where I mainly know her from. Portuguese actor, poet slash musician. Madden said that he had a friend who was Portuguese and all Portuguese people know each other. So he just got her number off of him. Again, you can't believe everything that Guy Madden says. Madden did want her for the part. He had seen her in other roles and thought that she would be perfect. She is the one that I feel the most sorry for, because with the aforementioned climate on set, she was by far and away the most uncomfortable. She was not used to that and apparently just seemed miserable the entire set when she was off screen. It's interesting. I don't know if you've listened to the film commentary, but Guy Madden will point out with some of her scenes that they would go to a nearby office building, especially when she had less clothes on. And they would have to do like an impromptu set in some other place just to kind of keep her happy. She's really great in her role. I mean, we will probably be coming back. In terms of the cast, we'll really quickly go through this. Playing Fyodor Kent, otherwise known as Chester Kent's father, is David Fox. The character is referred to as a former lieutenant from the Great War. He is a noted theater actor, but in terms of things that people have actually seen off of the stage, he had a long-running role in Road to Avon Lee as a schoolteacher Clive Pettibone, and he was nominated for Genie for a movie that I really want to do on this show called When Night is Falling. We have touched upon that in our other episode of Patricia Rosema, the director of both films for I've Heard the Mermaid Singing. So we do talk a little bit about When Night is Falling is there, because we do go into Rosema's career a bit, but I was surprised, I didn't put two and two together that they were the same person. So I just wanted to note that, because that's a movie that I really like and really want to do on the show. And then we have Ross McMillan as Roderick Kent, Winnipeg theater actor, and had collaborated with Madden before, specifically Careful, which is probably my favorite Guy Madden film, if I'm going to be completely honest with you, and Twilight of the Ice Nymphs. So that's our main cast that you mentioned in your preamble.
No, I thank you for telling me where I know David Fox from. Because he's so familiar. And now it makes sense that he's somewhere in my lizard brain of having watched Road, being forced to watch Road to Heavenly every Sunday. What was the name of the actor that does, who's the brother?
Ross McMillan.
He's another really great actor that I wish I'd seen him in more things. I think he's really good in this film.
Yeah, he's really great. And I watched it a couple of times for this recording, and weirdly, I really appreciated it more the second time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you really start paying attention to the sort of subtleties of the performances. We'll really quickly go behind the camera, because Guy Madden's films are so unique looking and there are just some interesting people. Production designer Matthew Davis, he has a crazy IMDb list, which includes a recent film that we've covered, Take This Waltz. And to note, recently the TV show Gen V, if you're into The Boys at all. But obviously, the production design on any Madden film is going to be off the hook. And we also have to mention the art director is Regine Labiere. Costuming, which is a key factor of any Madden film as well, is Meg McNillan. The score is by Christopher Derrick, who most notably was in the band Free Design back in the 60s. Not a band I was familiar with, but apparently they were quite influential. But later on in life does the scores for a lot of Canadian productions, TV and film. I really want to point out the cinematographer, Luc Montpellier, because he has come out a couple of times on the show, because he is the cinematographer for all of Sarah Polley's films. And I have been gradually going through that with my frequent guest, Melissa, which has been great. So I've really gotten a bigger sense of who Luc Montpellier is as a Canadian artist. Edited by David Warnsby. One thing that I did find really interesting about this is that none of these people have worked with Guy Madden before or since, which is really kind of rare with Canadian cinema. Like I said, with Sarah Polley, with Luc Montpellier, or David Cronenberg, you know, David's crew. It is pretty
loyal.
Common for people to go back to the same people, especially since the Canadian film industry is so small. I can't really speak as to why. I just thought that was interesting, right? Like, pretty much his editor and his art director are different, even though there is a sort of unified Madden world look. I find it interesting that those key roles change all the time, and just something I just kind of noticed and learned while I was doing research for this episode that I never noted before.
I wonder if it has to do with means, I don't know. I like you mentioned before, he had a $3.5 million budget for this. I don't know if he's had that since.
I can't remember. The only one that might have is My Winnipeg, and I can't remember what the budget for that was for, but I definitely know outside of that, this is the most money you ever had for a film, for sure, especially leading up to this. All right, well, let's go into the film itself. I'm a production designer, so I want to start off with the sets. The typical Guy Madden, especially early on, the minimalist sets. I love seeing any behind-the-scenes things for any of Guy Madden's films. They are sets that I would love to walk around and just kind of look to see how things are made and put together, because there's a sort of ramshackle quality. The making of for The Center of the World, I love, because you see how so many things are just pieces of cardboard put up that when you shine the light from behind, it's this big looming shadow figure in the background that you would never guess. I really think a lot about Isabella Rossellini's office, where you have like the big fans in the background and the sort of mock-up beer bottles kind of going by as if they're on a conveyor belt. I just think to myself, like, I would love to know how they're doing that. Is it literally people just moving like paper along? So anyways, that's where I wanted to start, because that's always something with Guy Madden that I'm super excited for.
Yeah, it has a real, it's a lush aesthetic, but at the same time, you do feel like it's a lot of tricks. It's a lot of lighting or shadow. One of the things that really struck me was the streetcar, and wondering how, what's the scale of that streetcar that's going by? Because it looks like it might be on a buggy or something. And then they cut to a different scene where they're climbing in through the top, and that could be anything else. But yeah, it seems like a lot of stage trickery more than anything.
I want to share a story about the streetcar, because I clearly remember the first time I saw this film. I was still living in Toronto, and I probably rented this from Suspect Video or something. And I guess my brain didn't click right away. It wasn't a long time, but it took a bit for me watching the film. I'm like, are those like weird submarines or something like that? And then it dawned on me like, oh, of course, it's because the snow is so high on each side. You're only seeing the top of it. And I just shook my head. I'm like, I can't believe it took me that long to figure this out. And then you look in the background and all the telephone poles are at eye level, right? Because the snow is so high. Guy Madden has said that with that set design idea, it saved tons of money because they only have to do the top floor of the houses inside the soundstage, right? And a lot of that, as you pointed out, is real snow because it was so cold on set. But I love that creativity, especially having set design work myself on really low budget productions. Like, I am way more impressed in something like a Guy Madden film than a big budget movie that has tons of money for special effects to look good. Right?
If you can create something with shadow and that kind of stuff, it's so much more impactful than. Well, I mean, it's funny. You say you're a production designer. My wife, her previous profession was as a set designer. And the kind of the joke she talks about is you design these sets that are so detailed, and like they're basically built so that the director can shoot any way they want. And then you watch the final product and everyone's shot in a close-up with really soft focus. So you see none of the detail, right? like none of the set is seen because of the depth of field of the shots, and just that it's not a concern of the directors. And I feel like with Guy Madden, the compositions of the shots are so important to him that the set design, the production design is as important basically as his actors. So he's very deliberately using techniques to create these kind of tableaus. And it doesn't matter how he creates them either. Like I said, I don't know anything about the background of how much of the stuff was built and how much of it was cardboard put in front of a light, but it feels like it might be 50-50.
You never know with Madden, but that's part of the fun and the adventure of it. Like when I saw that screening of Archangel, I call it 4-point watching. That instead of watching the center actors, I'm like, my eyes are quite often top right-hand side of the screen, left-hand side of the screen, bottom left, bottom right, and kind of going in and looking around. So I love doing that with Guy Madden's films, which is why I was so happy to see that projection of it, right? Because that experience is so good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also, there's a playfulness to the set design, even though, you know, you can go into how he's using German expressionistic influences, things like that, trying different lenses. Like I know for some of the shots he was talking about putting a 16 millimeter lens on a 8 millimeter camera and just having it not fit properly, but that gave it a certain look. It really reminded me of recently when we were talking about Norman McLaren and how Norman McLaren really loved the tactile interaction with the actual film of the project itself when he was working with that. I'm so glad that Guy Madden had the forethought for so many, even some of his smaller films, to have people filming him making the films on set. because unlike other Canadian filmmakers, there is a lot of footage of Guy Madden working. And I would like to think that there's even more that we just haven't seen yet. But there's really great making of documentaries about Center of the World. Twilight of the Ice Nymphs has a really good one, even though that was a boondoggle of a production that maybe we'll tackle here at some point. But to see the pictures of him and the footage of him climbing over top of things, standing above actors, underneath. We'll throw this out here now. During one of the scenes where there's a scuffle, a lot of actors have a cinematography credit because different actors were holding different cameras at certain points to get different perspectives. But you also get a feeling, because he has to work so quickly, that he's not precious either. He can't afford to be. So there's a lot of things on the fly. The end of the film, outside of Isabella Rossellini's scenes, he said the last 15 minutes of the film was filmed in one day. Because there's a lot of quick cutting and stuff like that. So he was literally like, okay, you're not doing anything. Grab a camera, start shooting stuff, and we'll figure it out in editing, because we literally do not have the space for one more day. So I love how there's like an auteurness about him, but because of the nature of him as a filmmaker, he can't be precious, right? Because you always think about the filmmakers like a Kubrick or a Christopher Nolan that are absolute perfectionists on set and have to get things a certain way. So it is more of an impression of a Guy Madden vision, what he can manage to get out before the art is literally taken away from them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they all, this one's no exception. They all seem to work as these kind of, like the montage, the editing is the most important part of them. Like that's really where it seems like almost the bulk of the writing happens is in the montage. They're really like these kind of collage films. And going back to the story with your friend and Archangel being the first thing that he views, it is, you know, already the silent film aesthetic and the kind of love of silent film, I think, is already a barrier. And then when you put on that, this kind of lack of fidelity for any sort of continuity and just wild thoughts put in there, because that's the wild thought that occurred to him in the moment, it can be really destabilizing as a viewer. But at the same time, if you're on for the ride, it's an amazing ride.
And especially with the bizarre, sometimes extremely dark humor. You really get the impression when you see it projected around strangers, people figuring out the film, if they're supposed to laugh or not laugh. My friend Colin thought that he was being pretty much completely earnest for the entire film. Right. And I'm like, you have never read an interview with Guy Madden if you think that is the case, right? So I think that's another thing that people find a little bit off-putting. Not only the subject matter, but how it's delivered is so absolutely bizarre sometimes.
Yeah, well, they feel like they should be art films, you know, capital A art films, and something that you would see in, you know, in a museum or something as an installation. So I think that does kind of put people on their back foot of, if something seems odd, is this supposed to be funny? But I even find that, I don't know how much stuff you consume from the 20s and 30s, but going into those movies, ones that weren't straight comedies, it is kind of, it's a little bit like watching a Japanese film, actually, where like if you're not quite on the wavelength of the humor, you can miss it, and you do wonder what's exactly happening.
Especially those pre-code ones.
Yeah,
you know, the screwball comedies and stuff like that, where people are just talking in a way that isn't normal, even though that fast screwball comedy dialogue is really great. At the same time, you're just like, what are they even saying?
Yeah,
at some points.
Yeah, and sometimes the characters are much more savvy than you assume they will be as characters from the 30s, right? Like, because everyone was so, you know, you assume everyone was more innocent the way your grandparents presented themselves to be. But at the same time, they're not. They can be quite dirty films. It's just, it's all subtext.
This didn't occur to me until now, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Around Christmas every single year, I go through a director watch project. Like, I watch every single one of that director's films. And this year I decided to do John Waters. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd seen most of John Waters' films, but it was nice. A lot of them I hadn't seen for a long time. So going back from the beginning, chronologically doing it, you kind of look at the films a little bit differently. And I'm only about four or five into them now. But there's some similarities between, especially early on, Waters and Madden a little bit. They have these different visions, very unique senses of humor, very on the fly with what you have around you, basically with your friends or who you can get when they start getting better name actors. But I didn't really put the two of that together. Now that I think about it, and again, because I'm watching John Waters and reading up on Madden, it wasn't until right now.
But also a loyalty to this place where they're from as well. You have Winnipeg, you have Baltimore, and they're these very unique places. And, you know, places that people don't really think about in general. And they have this kind of like love hate relationship with it and want to put it on the screen. I think it's actually an interesting comparison, especially because one of the things that people say about Guy Maddin is that, you know, there's a certain camp to his films. And certainly that's the case for John Waters as well. So they would be interesting to see, to kind of watch their filmographies together and see how they might be in dialogue.
All right. So just a couple of other notes. The next one that I have on my list is the theme of sadness and how this film talks about sadness and how we think about sadness and portray sadness in films.
I think it's interesting that the Guy Maddin wants to present Winnipeg as essentially what does he call it, it's essentially the saddest place in the world, right? That's what it's be presented as in this film.
Yeah, something along the lines that per capita it's the saddest person or something. Yeah. Like that. Yeah,
so I find that fascinating in terms of you know, growing up in Canada and you know, I grew up in a town called Peterborough, which is not Winnipeg. But you know, it's snowy, it's cold, it's all those things, and it's, you know, it feels, every time there's a recession, it feels it. So, you know, there's something to be said for that.
I kind of like the idea of the inspiration being how, as I brought up with the inspiration for Maddin, the way that sadness can be used as marketing. Mm. How sadness can be used as this sort of way of evoking pity or sympathy from someone. Mark McKinney's character outright says that he does not believe in sadness. He believes that sadness is a manipulative tool. And obviously on the other side you have his brother, who's the complete opposite. He is defined by his sorrow and his sadness because his wife is gone, his child is dead. He literally walks around with an infant's heart in a jar pickled by his own tears around his neck. And I think that's a really interesting idea, and it kind of made me think about, like, I do think things like sadness and depression can be weaponized, even by an individual, their own sadness and depression, and use that as a tool for manipulating others. And I think this movie really comes at a lot of different angles with that. Like, it comes with it from the personal point of view with the brother character, but then it also comes to from the corporate point of view with Isabella Rossellini, right? The idea that she's going to play upon the fact that this is the saddest place in the world, and therefore they are the perfect ones to choose the saddest music because Prohibition is going to be ending soon in the States. So she wants to use sadness to market her beer better for when that border opens up so she can get as much of the market as possible. And it's a movie, before doing research, you kind of take on the surface, right? But the more that I read up on it and the different sources, the more my brain started to go about those things and those sort of topics. And that is really much more of a canny, I don't want to say smart, but a canny, cunning movie than you initially think of when either you read the tin or you first initially watch it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. So tell me more about your research then, in terms of what you came up with. Did you come up with like historical instances in which corporations are acting like vultures around this concept of sadness? I mean, I guess there's the pharmaceutical companies.
Well, you could also you can take like a lot of environmentalism. Like we both remember in the 90s when a lot of companies would slap green onto a product to try to get people to buy it more. That's more out of guilt for people than sadness. Well, I guess it could be sadness about the environment. During the 80s, there were a lot of instances when everybody was talking about the famine in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Trying to drum up business that way. Going back, I mean, I remember, not in research for this, but examples of shucksters during the Irish potato famine, you know, collecting funds and completely pocketing to it. They would go to Irish neighborhoods and places like Boston and New York, canvassing for, you know, the great famine that's been going on. And people sometimes who didn't have the money would give money towards that.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So, and you always hear about religious organizations, not all. My sister, the minister, I don't know if you would listen to this one, but, you know, a lot of churches do a lot of great works, but we also hear about a lot of scams out there, right? Mm-hmm. So this movie doesn't talk about those ideas and say them outright, but once you know what was going through Maddin's mind, you can see those elements throughout the entire film, especially with Rossellini's character in the beer company and why this saddest music, like, it is for a capitalist reason, but using the idea of sadness, right? It's a marketing shtick. And then that, again, is juxtaposed with the people who are actually sad, to the point, spoiler, we're not doing a plot beat by beat thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, by the end of the film, when Mark McKinney feels sadness seemingly for the first time, and it's not just because he was just stabbed and is going to burn to death, I read it as he realizes the destruction that he has basically wrought by doing this and getting back into cahoots with Isabella Rossellini, because of denial or greed or whatever, just didn't allow that in. So that sadness as catharsis, right? Sorrow as catharsis, losing somebody important to you and re-examining your whole life based upon that, even if in Mark McKinney's case, it's at the end of his life because of it. Anyways, it is called The Saddest Music in the World. I just figured I would spitball and kind of talk about that.
Well, can we talk about the saddest music in the world, meaning the scene in which we see the various incarnations of the saddest music in the world? We have all these groups playing the music that they brought to this this contest.
Yes, musicians from, quote, all over the world. They were all from Winnipeg, actually. And Madden, yes, when he put out a casting call, was very shocked how many amazing, talented musicians that they had that played music from all over the world in Winnipeg. Again, with saving on the budget, apparently a lot of the musicians' clothes are their own clothes, which I thought
that was my question.
Funny.
That was my question to you, because we talk about him being a fabulous and saying things like that aren't patently untrue. Do you think that assertion is true? Because it seems to me that all of these cultures are presented in like their most essential form, you know?
Most stereotypical. Yeah. Like he does talk about when they misspeak about like where certain people are from.
Yeah.
Or use improper terms, he is making a direct reference to films of the 30s that had no care for geography whatsoever. Like, that's completely intentional. Yeah. In terms of whether that's a fabulous statement, and thank you again for coming up with fabulous, because that really encapsulates well. It could be. It very much could be. I don't know if I had my traditional Mexican mariachi garb, if I'd want to go down a slide into a big vat of beer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is a budget of $3.5 million, was it?
Yeah,
I lost that page in my notes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is some money and they do have a costume designer, so it could be a fib, but it's something that comes up a lot as well. I think even Mark McKinney comments on it on the commentary, because that commentary is neat because it's Guy Madden and Mark McKinney. Yeah. So it's interesting hearing the two of them talking together, but it could be.
Yeah, it seems to me, I'm glad we were on the same page too. It seems to me that he's very much doing a representation of kind of 30s tropes of what other cultures look like, rather than, you know, the film itself being like inherently racist or essentialist or anything like that. I feel like it really is a send up of what you would see in a film like for instance, The Villagers and King Kong. That's kind of the example that comes to my mind first and foremost, and you know, some of the stuff he presents in this is not that different from that 1933 film. But that's one of the things in the research that kind of struck me as like, it doesn't seem like it would be their own clothes, because these really do seem to be like early 20th century stereotypes of what these cultures are.
Yeah, again, it's one of those things that until you start talking to somebody about it, you don't really think about too much unless somebody brings it up. Because you're absolutely right. The musicians that are from Siam, I don't know if they would necessarily have grass skirts hanging up in their closets at home, so that's a very good point.
And then there's ones from Cameroon that I think they're essentially just wearing loincloths.
Yeah, exactly. And to say there, you see on the chalkboards a lot of different countries, but generally the ones that we see performing are from Siam, Mexico. We have David Fox representing Canada, Cameroon, Spain versus Scotland in one scene.
Right.
And also some Indian musicians who, after they are out of the competition, Mark McKinney convinces to play, because this is a term in the film, why I will say it, but to play Eskimos is what he says.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. David Fox's song, too, made me laugh. Essentially, he begins by knocking over the piano and talking about Vimy Ridge. And as someone who has worked the better part of 10 years in working in like Canadian history, it made me laugh, this idea of like, what's the saddest music in the world? I'm gonna talk to you about Vimy Ridge.
Well, but that's the other part of sadness, right? PTSD, which was so completely in for the time period, you know, the era of shell shock, was so discounted. Right? Like, you just wouldn't address. So it's interesting that that aspect comes in too, the sort of long-term trauma of an entire generation that went to war and like World War II had to go home and basically shut up about it and move on with your life. Mm-hmm. In terms of the competition, I'll just really quickly note, I looked around. I don't think the score, and which I love the score, or the soundtrack is available to stream anywhere. There was a CD released at some point, which I never owned. If anybody listening out there knows if there's any place to listen to this online, definitely fire me off an email, because I really enjoyed it. And I would love to hear, especially the international music when it's being played on kind of separate tracks, just to see, because it's a little bit unclear. We noted the score, but how many of the songs the musicians brought in themselves, like how many of them were written for them or how many of them did they just play?
Oh,
I
like
think
the
that's
idea
kind of an interesting thing. Yeah.
Like the idea is that they may be like, you know, Ukrainian, like a Ukrainian band, and they would play what they would normally play. That's what you're thinking may have been some of the music, the way the music was chosen.
I'm not sure. It's just something that crossed my mind while I was watching.
Yeah.
Now I really quickly wanted to go into the performances. Mm-hmm. They're all really solid. I've read interviews about other Madden films that, like a lot of directors with kind of heightened or nuanced dialogue, it can be a tough thing to wrap your head around. Although it does seem Mark McKinney was born to deliver Guy Madden dialogue. Like the way he delivers his lines and other things, like in The Kids and stuff like that, just seem to match up perfectly. Like Mark McKinney barely had to change his shtick at all to fit into a Guy Madden world.
Absolutely. It feels like it could fit right into an episode of Kids in the Hall in terms of his performance, and not in a complimentary way, not in not to denigrate it.
Well, we talked about Saturday Night Live and how they didn't know how to use him. And like I said, he spent years just popping up in these shitty comedies and these sort of bit parts that it could be like, hey, we like Mark. Let's get him in to do this walk on or play the concierge at a hotel or something like that for one scene. Right. And you can say that about all of the kids. Like how brilliant is Kevin McDonald, but it's so hard to get him to fit into the right project. Because as you did looking up in the history of Brain Candy, he's not really a leading man type. Mm-hmm. So for pretty much all of them outside of Dave Foley, there was that problem, right? So it's interesting that, you know, McKinney has this sort of, not a dry spell, but a fallow period, shall we say, of trying to figure out what to do. And hey, it's Guy Madden that actually figured it out. And it's really sad. I don't think they worked together again. Even at the commentary, they were like, oh yeah, we should definitely work together sometime soon. And as far as I know, they've never worked together again. Things get complicated, obviously, in terms of scheduling and projects and stuff like that. But just noting, particularly when I rewatched it, the one thing that I thought was really interesting is that certain pairings are really, really interesting and I think really sing well with each other. And that would be Mark McKinney and Isabella Rossellini. Their two presences and personality on screen, I think, are really, really interesting. The way that they play off each other, and because they're both bringing so much of their vibe to the role, seeing Mark McKinney and Isabella Rossellini's energy just kind of bounce up against each other and doing this material, I think, is really cool. And the other one I wanted to point out is David Fox as Fyodor Kent and Ross McMillan as Roderick Kent. I think their scenes together, they have a really good banter and pitter patter. And I gather, and Guy Madden touched upon this really quickly, that they could go through their scenes really, really quickly because they both had so much theater experience and had worked together so well that they just immediately had a rapport. And you can really see that on screen as well. I love any single time that it's just the two of those on screen together, I think is really, really interesting.
I think going back to Isabella Rossellini too, the thing that kind of almost floored me actually in rewatching this, because it had been a few years, is her performance in this fits with the aesthetic. And what I mean by that is that she's giving a silent film performance in a really nuanced, smart way. Like if you take a film like The Artist, do you remember The Artist, the one that won the Academy Award? Yeah. So those are silent film performances that are made by people that like have a little bit of an understanding of silent film, but really it's kind of these broad stroke. This is what silent film acting is. Whereas hers is someone who's like steeped in film culture that understands that you can have a performance like the Passion of Joan of Arc. You can have a performance like that actress whose name is escaping me right now.
Is it Maria Falconetti?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
That is just so human and naturalistic, but at the same time being melodramatic, and Rosaline just hits it perfectly. She's just, it's honestly the best modern silent film acting I've seen anyone do.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up The Passion of Joan of Arc, because when the topic comes up is what you think is one of the best acting performances of all time. Falconetti in that film is always one of the first go-tos that is still seared in my brain, because I was lucky enough when I lived in Toronto to see a projection of it. Those close-ups of her face and her eyes in that film just is burned into my brain. Yeah. It will never, ever leave.
Yeah, and she's someone who I don't think I'm wrong in saying this, too. I think that was her only on-screen performance. I think that's
I believe you're correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe you're correct. It's been a long time since I've seen it and looked into it, but I believe you're right. I believe you're right with that. But
yeah, Rossellini, her performance in this is just perfect. And I understand why she and Madden worked together again after, because she just seems like the perfect vessel for his work.
On the commentary, he noted the scene with the small bathtub that Mark McKinney throws her into, yeah, and her wig comes off. He noted that one thing that he really liked about working with Isabella is that she's not afraid to get ugly. He's like, here's a woman who made so much money as a fashion model, but is so not precious at all about how she comes across on film. Look at Blue Velvet. When we her character, you know, that is one of the rawest, most, no pun intended, but bare raw scenes ever committed to film.
Yeah, that was one of the things that Ebert found really offensive about that movie, wasn't it? Was the way that Isabella Rossellini was treated in it. Like, he gave that a negative review because of the way Isabella Rossellini was treated in that film.
And I feel like we should just throw it there because she's kind of being overshadowed in our conversation. Maria de Medeiros. Mm-hmm. I think she's really good in the role. I didn't know until research how unhappy she was on set, apparently. But I could definitely see why they would cast her for that role. There are so many other almost more heightened performances. She kind of gets pushed to the side a little bit. But I could totally see why when they wrote that role, they had her in mind. And again, going back to Luc Montpellier and the cinematography, like, absolutely beautiful. She looks like a silent starlet in certain shots, right? You could almost do a transition from an early Mary Pickford film to her in some of the close-ups that they give her. Like, Luc Montpellier's camera, like, absolutely loves her face.
Yeah, she has the tiny features but big eyes. She feels like she's from a totally another time. And she's great in this movie. Like, I know she, I don't know if you listen to other film podcasts, but she's become kind of synonymous with bad acting in terms of there's a category on the Rewatchables named after her performance in Pulp Fiction.
Everybody picks on her for Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Like, that really ticks me off.
But she's fantastic at this. And I think when you're doing this kind of silent film aesthetic too, I think casting is one of the big things, right? Because you want to find these actors that feel almost timeless in their faces.
Which Guy Madden generally has a really great track record of doing, right? So
yeah. I think, I mean, just in terms of reading about this film, one of the things that struck me that didn't strike me in the watching was the fact that I don't think I'm overstating this, but Ace in the Hole was a inspiration. The Billy Wilder film with Kirk Douglas was an inspiration for this film. And that kind of like anti-hero down on his luck, trying to get back into the good graces of the profession that he wants to be in, and basically exploiting the situation he finds. And knowing that Ace in the Hole was an inspiration for the Mark McKinney character, I feel like it gave me so much more to like bite into in terms of the story, kind of looking at it with that kind of film history background. I really enjoyed it on the rewatch with that knowledge.
That's really cool. I did not come across that. Now, to be clear, it was an influence on Madden or Mark McKinney in his performance or
in the writing. So it was Guy Madden trying to do an Ace in the Hole kind of story.
Interesting.
Yeah. And knowing that, I know now knowing that, I'm sure for you too, it's like, oh yeah, I can completely see it. And it feels like it's within this genre. Cause this film can sometimes feel like it's not within any kind of like context of other films other than its aesthetic, but it feels very much its own thing. But then kind of seeing the way Madden's influences inform even his screenwriting, I find interesting as just someone who's, you know, who studied film and loves film history as a pastime. I really enjoyed knowing that little bit about it.
That is really, really cool. Yeah, I'll definitely keep an eye out for that. So I like to mention to people where films are available. This is actually, you can see it for free on Tubi. which I think was really nice. I have my old DVD copy from back in the day, so that was cool. I could pull it out and dust it off, but it is available right now. So we do like to mention that.
What are the extras like on that DVD?
There is a making of featurette and then the commentary.
Oh, nice. Okay.
You know, it's an early 2000s DVD. It's not quite old enough to have menu titles as a feature, like on the back of the DVD box where it say interactive menus, you know.
Yeah.
But it's something that I appreciate being there, put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, as someone who likes context and likes the history of how something's made, I always like that. That's kind of why I still keep my physical media, is actually for the paratextual stuff, not so much the film itself, because, you know, there are better versions of most of the films out there if I don't own them on Blu-ray.
Yeah, a move recently, I had to pare down on a lot of things. So unfortunately, I did have to get rid of a lot of DVDs. Basically, I went through and I'm like, if I can't foresee myself watching this in the future for however many years, I might as well just get rid of it and make sure it gets to a good home. But anything that was Canadian or Canadian adjacent, like a Canadian director in the States or a Canadian actor in a film, I kept every single one of those, because you never know where those commentaries are going to pop up or where they can be useful. And I have to say this again, I didn't use it as a resource for this film, but whenever people put up film commentaries on YouTube and places like that, that you can access that I've used before in the past, thank you so much. I keep saying this, I should go through my commentaries and see if I could do that and get them available out there, because I have some pretty neat ones from some movies that the physical media wasn't exactly popular at the time.
I mean, that certainly helped me with Cronenberg. I was able to access the Videodrome was one of the ones I don't own a physical copy of, and someone had uploaded the commentary, which is, it's David talking about David and I think the cinematographer talking about the film, which is just, you know, invaluable when you're trying to find this kind of background information.
I'm pretty sure I did the same thing. I know Video Time was on the Criterion channel at the time, but I think that wasn't one of the ones, because sometimes they put commentaries up there. But I do have to say, because I did so much research, like the books that you cited for the Kids in the Hall episodes, I'd independently read both of those.
Yeah.
And for a Cronenberg, obviously, I have a lot of material, and there would be facts or points that come up that would be like, I wonder if we got that here, or I wonder if we got that here, right? So it's interesting talking to you about this stuff, right? Because we both have research, like the exact same topics, that I was like, I remember reading that on Cronenberg. Yeah. Or I remember that coming up in the film commentary for Dead Ringers. So, and we on the show like to cite our sources as well. These are not sources that we have not brought up in the past.
Yeah.
All right, shall we go into the after? I know you have kids doing things, and I don't want to keep you for too much longer. You never know into these how long they're going to last, right? So
yeah, it's no worries.
All right, so we'll really quickly go into the after part here. Guy Maddin had said that when he was talking to producers and stuff like that, they encouraged him to make a film that was more approachable than a standard fare, especially getting a star that they had sought out at the beginning in terms of Isabella Rossellini. However, it was overall a disappointment, making $855,000 off of the $3.5 million budget. But if there was any pressure on Maddin, number one, we're talking about Guy Maddin here, right? This, at this date, and still is his highest grossing film. I had to double check, because the only one I could think of that might have gotten close is My Winnipeg. But even My Winnipeg only made about $500,000 in the theater. But this was the last time that Maddin took like a big swing in terms of getting like major stars in this film. The films, much like Cronenberg had to do after films like M. Butterfly, that got really big and out of control and they underperform. He always has to scale back and bring it back down. So that's kind of what he did. It is to note, though, that it did win the Genie for costume design, editing, and music at that year's Genie Awards, which I think is well-deserved. And Maddin was nominated for Best Director. Yeah, that's about it on my end. It was really good. This didn't spin out of control in terms of research like some other recent ones where I go into the National Film Board and really kind of deep dives into subjects. It was fun. You know, there wasn't a lot of pressure with this one. It was really good to just kind of chill out. And like I said, with the Archangel screening, just kind of get back into Guy Maddin, because other than when like some of his short films pop up on the Criterion channel or something like that, he's not somebody that I've really revisited a lot over the last few years, unless one of his films come up here for research. So between this and the Archangel experience, it was really fun really getting back into Guy Maddin. So thank you. It was a really excuse to do that. So thank you so much for reaching out and getting in contact with us.
Oh, thanks. Well, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate talking about Guy as well. He's you know, one of my favorite Canadian filmmakers, and I know he makes stuff all the time, but I wish he made stuff on this scale. You know, when I watch something like 20th Century, if I don't know if you've seen that film, the Matthew Rankin film.
I love that movie, and I would love to do on this show is just finding the right guest.
Yeah.
As somebody that would be able to, I say that all the time. There's so many films I want to do on this show that I always joke that Last Night is one of my favorite films ever made, the Don McKellar film. And the fact that it took me to episode 50 or 51 to do that. And it's one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah.
I appreciate people sending in recommendations, but saying, why haven't you gotten around to this film yet in emails? I'm always like, it takes a long time, man, for some of these.
Yeah, of course. And you also have to, I mean, it's the same for my show, is that you, like, if you're going to invest something, you kind of like want to kind of put your interest somewhere, but then you have to kind of go somewhere different for the next one, then somewhere different for the next one. You don't want to kind of stay on the same wavelength for too long. But yeah, I was going to say, with 20th Century, you see now the influence of Guy Maddin on younger filmmakers, but he's not an old guy. And I, you know, I just wish he was making features at this scale right now.
Not to compare to John Waters, but But John Waters, you know, like, stop after A Dirty Shame, just stop making films, because one, it was tough to budget. And two, he's like, I don't have the energy, especially with these low budget films where I'm responsible for so much. It's not worth the energy in this current market. So maybe that's something to do with Guy Maddin, because The Green Fog?
Yeah.
Is that his last film? Came out in 2017.
Yeah.
But it's like you brought up that really cool art project that I wish I could have seen, the Seance one.
Yeah, Seance, that
with art shows, and he's teaching and stuff like that. Yeah,
so you're right. Come watch him film and all that stuff. And he's doing it at the National Film Board. He's doing it at the Centre Pompidou. He's doing it here. He's doing it there. Like, maybe that's the future for him. But yeah, when you talk about John Waters, and hasn't made a film in, what was Dirty Shame, was that 15 years ago? The market has changed so much since then. So if he's having it tough then, like, I can't imagine what this streaming world and this lack of theater windows and all that, like, it's just, I mean, for guys like you and me, it's really depressing, I think, to think like film is not the dominant cultural form anymore. And
many other art forms where that can happen, you know, the passionate people. Obviously, it's not always going to happen, but you are going to have certain people that are passionate enough to get the stuff made regardless.
Yeah.
There's always going to be good art being made. You just need to put forth the effort to find it.
Yeah.
Or just to be aware. It always happens. Whenever people get down about the state of movies and how blockbusters have taken over, you know, always my favorite movies of the year are these sort of underperforming ones. And it's because I'm vigilant. I have lists that I keep in my phone when I come across an article.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh, The Angry Beaver seems really interesting. Going to put that down into my phone and periodically just see if they've been released anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks again for being here. Again, North of Normal, people are always welcome back. So don't be a stranger on that if it tickles your fancy. Where can people find your show?
Anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can find Once Upon a Time in Hollywood North and Among Equals. And I also, if I can do a little plug, because I said I'm into silent film, I also put out a book this year. About the life and about the life and films of Buster Keaton. It's a graphic novel biography of Buster Keaton. So if you're looking for a gift for anyone who loves films, please look up. It's called Buster, A Life in Pictures. It's written by me and drawn by a Toronto artist named Matthew Tavares.
Interesting. And where can people find that?
You can just find it on Amazon here. You want to see a copy of it?
Yeah, sure. I think I might have come across this just completely separately.
This will be useless for your podcast listening group, but there's the book.
I have seen that online completely separately from our conversations. That's really crazy. That's really, really interesting. Because I love Buster Keaton as well. Like, I'm a Buster Keaton guy. Out of the Harry Lloyd Chaplin, Buster Keaton trio, I'm a Buster Keaton guy.
He's your guy? Yeah, he's my guy too. All right. I hope people will check out the book. It's available where books are sold. So please, thank you again. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, we could probably prattle on forever, but for both your time frame and what you have to do, and also for our listeners, we'll pull the plug right here. Okay, so sure. Thanks again.
That's good. Thank you. All right.
North of Normal is a production of Eldritch Creative that can be found on Facebook at Eldritch Creative and Instagram at eldritch.creative. North of Normal can be found on Facebook at North of Normal Pod and Instagram at North of Normal Pod. Intro and outro music is by Dad vs. Son out of Hamilton, Ontario. That's it for now. Be soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.